Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you very much, Martin, for that disclaimer. We appreciate that. You know, I've been
Martin. That is my ramble for this evening, folks.
All right. For that disclaimer, I appreciate that. Our speaker this evening is John, and John will be covering a subject that is favorite to me. He started this a week ago, 2 weeks ago, actually. We're going to be alternating Ringo between their two classes, so John will be continuing his class today. What I want to start off with, though, is a quote. And this quote perhaps declares in unequivocal terms exactly how and where and why our problems are that we have today, whether it's with the IRS or the federal government in any way, shape, or form, or what we think are our state governments, which are not. So this is it was stated by the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice John Marshall Harlan. In fact, in this quote, he predicted much as what has happened and occurred through today. Quote, "The idea prevails with some, indeed it has found expression in arguments at the bar, that we have in this country substantially two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all of the restrictions, the other to be maintained by the Congress, outside and independently of that instrument. Now listen to this part. By exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to." It continues, "I take leave to say that if the principles thus announced should ever receive the authority of this court, a radical and mischievous change in our system of government will result. We will, in that event, pass from the era of constitutional liberty, Constitution, into an era of legislative absolutism. It will be an evil day for American liberty if the government outside the supreme law of the land finds lodgment in our constitutional jurisprudence. No higher duty rests upon this court to prevent all violation of the principles of the Constitution." You'll find this quote at Downs versus Bidwell, 182 U.S. 244. So with that as the background, it's my pleasure at this time to turn the call over to Bruce.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Jurisdiction has many facets. Some of them are shocking. Among those, we're going to be covering off and on jurisdiction over probably at least once a month for probably the next 6 months or year. Jurisdiction itself is that broad of a subject. And to that end, we're going to cover tonight jurisdiction inside the court while it is in session. And the thing is that presently, most judges are and most attorneys are members of an association that you can trace back to the British Accreditation Registry, or BAR for short. Now, the bar has actually been expanded to now ISO 9000, ISO 1401 credentials, environmental, all kinds of. But originally, the there were just 100 years ago, there were very few disciplines within the British Accreditation Registry. This is the bar is an association. There is no legislation to support the bar at this time, meaning that it says there's a law that says if you don't do this, then you can't do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they identify two classes of people or two jurisdictions for you to speak or not to speak in the courtroom. And eventually, we're going to bring this full circle so that we begin to see how all of these different designations begin to apply. But what happens is that the bar is an association, and you can look it up on the internet and do quick searches on there, and you can even look for the definition of bar under Wikipedia or any one of the search engines. And what you'll find out is that it's always an association. And recently, a couple was excluded from making any statements in a courtroom because they weren't were not a member of the bar. And presently, there's a widow's son that was precluded from making statements in a courtroom, and the trustee for the charitable religious trust in the corpse soul, that the designee, the trustee's designee, was not allowed to speak either. Presently, if a person is not a member of an association, does that mean that their rights to speak in court have now been deprived of them? And to that end, in this particular case, it begs the question, how serious and how far does that go? And there's quite a few people on this call that have corporation souls and charitable religious trust, and the trustee for those in many courtrooms is not allowed to speak because they say under corporate law, under United States corporate or state corporate law, you must have an attorney, a member of the bar. And that's what they're saying. It actually says they must be represented. And so they're construing it to mean the bar. However, if you're the trustee and you're the party withstanding and you're an indispensable party to that action, would that be considered a deprivation of civil rights under color of law, policy, practice, or procedure to preclude you from speaking? My personal observation is it does. It is a deprivation of your civil rights. And to that end, the widow whose son was not allowed to speak, or the trustee for the trustee's designee in a recent hearing, we're asking the judge, it's a state superior court judge, to recuse herself and step down. Because where in the Constitution does it say that an individual cannot speak in court, or their rights to plead their case when they're an indispensable party are stripped from them because they are not a member of this association? And one could even take it farther to say that this association is a social club, because there is no legal basis for it. It's something that's held amongst, that's a carry over from the British law that, excuse me, that is held quite without any statutes or law. And I, many years ago, well, not that many years ago, about 11 years ago, we had a, I appeared at Amicus Curiae for a family that had two children taken by CPS, and the this Caucasian family of three children, two girls and a boy, mom and dad, adopted a boy and a girl, brother and sister, 2 years apart, that were black. And a neighbor who did not like somebody adding a little color to the monochromatic proceedings and exploits of their neighborhood began to make complaints, that all kinds of complaints, but they were all ignored or turned down by the constabulary and child protective services, until they said, the one lady said, well, she had witnessed the children being slapped around and abused. And finally, they, CPS came and grabbed the children, and there was a hearing, and I was there in my suit and tie, and in my wheelchair, and we the ADA came up. There were two female ADAs and two attorneys for CPS, one male, one female, and there was a state prosecutor there. And one of the ADAs walked up, and I was standing there, and says, you here with the family? I says, yeah. I says, what firm do you practice with? I says, I don't. I'm individual. Oh, really? Got your own shingle? I says, well, kind of, sort of. She says, where'd you go to school? I says, USC. And says, where'd you take the bar? I says, California. Oh, do you have a license to practice in Texas? I says, no. I says, she says, so you're only licensed to practice in California? And I says, no. She says, what do you mean, no? That's where you took your bar. And I says, yes. And she goes, you mean you don't have a license to practice? I says, no. And all of a sudden, the other ADA who was standing close by overheard the thing, and both attorneys for Texas Child Protective Services all heard that. The courtroom was so quiet, you could hear a pin drop. Less than a minute later, the judge came on the stand, and both ADAs, assistant district attorneys, strolled up to the thing and says, Your Honor, we have to protest. We've got a complaint, a criminal complaint. This man here is practicing law without a license. And he says, do you have a Texas license to practice in Texas? There, he called me young man, and I was at least 20 years older than the judge at the time. And he called me young man, and I get that a lot. But I says, no, sir, I don't. He says, well, what do you have to say for yourself? I says, well, that's a good question. And did the honorable court want an answer? And this is, we're courts in session. And he goes, And he stumbled a little bit and kind of stuttered. I says, no, you're just being kind of the tall, funny looking guy in the lime green wheelchair, you know, and he cracked a smile. He says, no, I think, I says, no, you're just being nice to the guy that, you know. He goes, no, I want an answer. And immediately both ADAs objected. And, so as one of the CPS attorneys. And he says, they said, objection, Your Honor. And he says, overruled. I'm going to listen to him. But Your Honor. So I says, well, Your Honor, the license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal. Isn't that correct? And all the attorneys and the judge all said, yeah, you're right on, you know. And I says, so, if my chosen pursuit in life was jurisprudence, does that mean because I don't have this license, that is not issued by the state but by associations, that I can't earn a living and I can't go, you know, pay my bills, or would that be considered a deprivation of civil rights under color of law under 18 U.S.C. 242 and considered a felony? Or if somebody was saying that they couldn't, would that be considered a felony for conspiracy under 18 U.S.C. 241? And all the attorneys objected, and now they're all standing at the bench right beside me, and they're arguing. And the judge says, put a sock in it. I asked the question. And he told the attorneys, and one of them said, but, Your Honor, this is highly – he says, shut up, or I will find you in contempt. I'm listening to him right now. I asked him for an answer. When I ask you, then you can talk. He says, but until then, if you want to object, you will hold up your hand. And it was like – and he says, so why are you here? I says, well, these are friends. I'm appearing amicus curiae. He says, you seem to have some legal background. I says, well, I might have. There, you know, and he says, what is it? I says, well, there might be a shingle at home that makes a rumorous allegation that I may have a law degree that and major in constitutional with a minor in criminal. And he says, so did you take the bar? I says, oh, yeah. And he says, what state? And I told him, California. He said, what school? Yeah, USC. And we were talking, and he goes, you know what? I'm going to overrule all of your objections, and I'm going to allow him to represent the family. I says, well, that's very gracious of you. I was just here, amicus curiae, actually. He says, how could you be here? Wait a minute. Do you have an order that you would like me to sign? He says, I'm betting you've got an order. And I reached down in my folder, and I says, it's funny you should say that. I just happen to have one here. And he signed an order allowing me to practice and appear in his court anytime for the rest of my life in the 271st family court there. And and then he says, so amicus curiae. I says, how could you be appearing amicus curiae? You realize, you know what that definition is? I says, yes, sir, friend of the court. He says, so you're come here to be my friend? And the attorneys were object, object, object. I says, yes, Your Honor. He says, how could you be my friend? I says, well, if there was an opportunity to make the court aware of something that could have potential felony implications and void the honorable court's oath of office and his 19 years, 3 months, 12 days of tenure. And he looked at me so shocked, you know, when I said that. He says, wait a minute. He looked down, he calculated. He says, how'd you know that? I says, know what? And he started to laugh. He says, go on, youngster. He called me youngster. And he says, go on. I says, if I were something I could show you that could prevent you from possibly committing a federal crime, I says, would that interest you? And he said, absolutely it would. And they're objecting. And he says, you guys I told you, if you erupted again, I was going to find one or more of you in contempt. And can you hear me okay? Are you able to hear me okay? I heard some static a little bit ago. Okay, but...
I was muted. I'm fine. I was muted. I'm fine.
Hey, you can hear me? Okay, good.
Perfectly.
I says, you know, at this juncture, CPS does not have jurisdiction over the children. He says, and that would be because, I says, neither of the children have a birth certificate. They, the etymology of the birth certificate gives the state authority over the individual that is born. Originally, birth certificates were required for only one class of people. He says, I know the answer to that. He says it was slaves, and it was in the 1800s. I says, yes, Your Honor. So that the property of a union of two different owned properties from two different plantations, so that not one plantation owner or the other could claim jurisdiction, the state had to step in. But that's why the state has jurisdiction. He says, yes. He says, three of my five children are recorded in the family Bible. We don't have birth certificates either. And the attorney for CPS object. He says, you should listen to this because I've got a feeling that he's about to have you charged with a federal felony and for conspiracy of deprivation of civil rights under color of law. I says, you know the statute? And he goes, yes, sir. He goes, yes, young man, I do. And before I could ask, the clerk had already printed out a copy of the statute. He says, I want four of those, and 241 and 242. And I want them handed out to both ADAs and the CPS. And what happened was that they looked at him, and they says, you object, Your Honor? This is highly... He says, you should finish listening to him. I bet he's got more to say. You know, and I says, if kidnapping occurs, you know, the death penalty can apply. And I says, Your Honor, what is the statute for wrongful arrest or wrongful detention? He goes, oh, that's simple. There isn't one. I says, yes, it's kidnapping under color of law. And both CPS agents or attorneys and both agents all erupted. He says, shh, real serious. But what happened was that the thing that gave them jurisdiction in this case was the birth certificate. That's why also when you get married, you know, if you have a marriage license, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal. The license was originally there to permit property from two separate jurisdictions or ownerships, absolute ownerships, meaning slavery, to be joined. And they had to have permission. And now, because they were from two different jurisdictions, they had to have the blessing of the state. Because the state realized that, and in the first colony that did it was Virginia, that one or the other could claim inordinate jurisdiction over the marriage and the children. So they had to come up with a whole batch of statutes to justify what was transpiring. Most of this is very, very hidden now, and it's hard to find on the internet. If you go look up the British Accreditation Registry, not the British Aristocracy Registry, which is what a lot of people say, but if you look up the British Accreditation Registry, you go to bar.registrars.org, you can find out about, you know, the British Accreditation Registry, but like the, a lot of this about the etymology of the marriage license and the birth certificate is very, very hard to find, and it gives them jurisdiction over the children. And so what happens is that by seeking their license or certification, you are providing them with jurisdiction. It's very, very important that when you're proceeding through with agreements and et cetera, as you go through life, that for you and your children, that you don't unnecessarily entangle them. For me, most of you are probably too young to remember that up until 1973, the socialist insecurity system, I mean the social security system, everyone had their own individual account number and their own individual account. But after 1973, the funds were all commingled into the general fund. And so what happens is that they changed the terms of the contract post, ex post facto, meaning after you signed the contract. And they regularly send out little notices saying, this is an update to the socialist insecurity, social security system. And if you don't object to those, it's held as you agree. And you're admitting or participating in their law and their jurisdiction on Social Security. And one thing is that they say to be eligible for the benefits, you're now automatically liable for the debt. And so if you're applying for Social Security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I got some interesting fan mail from, I don't technically have a, although I don't use a Social Security number and haven't had one, and they actually disconnected it technically from me many years ago. The government never destroys the accounting system for which somebody paid in some money that they could later be sued for. So even if you were, you know, you went through all the trouble of having your Social Security number rescinded, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that accounting number is there till the cows grow old. And there's not a thing in this green earth that you can do about it. And there are people that can still find it, except that when they disconnect it, you're not required to make regular deposits, and they can't trace where the deposits were coming from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and based on what I had in the early 80s when they did my – I got a thing a while back, about 5 years ago, that they were offering me like $3,300 or almost $3,400 a month benefits. And hold on a second here. My I just got one of those child abduction alerts here. But what happens is, yeah, exactly. But what happens is that you have provided them with jurisdiction. And when we were in that hearing, I was able to answer. The judge was very kind and allowed me to, he even had guided discussion and asked questions that were thought-provoking that allowed me to answer, so that CPS, when we got done, we left friends. It wasn't adversarial, but the two CPS agents, they come up and ask me, are you going to press federal charges against us? I says, well, it looks like you thought you were doing the best you could, the best way you knew how before, and you were acting with a lack of knowledge, paraphrased in ignorance, but you were still trying to do the best you could, the best way you knew how, out of good and absolutely good intentions. And if you worked for me, I would want you to do that. Wait a minute. This is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and you do work for me. And immediately when I said that, one of the ADAs turned around and says, does that include me? I says, you're not going to try to press charges against me? And I says, well, it looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys all know now what is right and what's correct. And, you know, you understand that, you know, the jurisdiction here and the challenges of it, is that a, you know, and I kind of held up my hand. Does everybody agree with that? And the one ADA elbowed the other one and says, you agree with that? And she turned around and says, I've been listening. And I says, well, I'm, you know what, maybe I need to, I'm not a very good communicator. No, 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 we all agree. And they all agreed. And I says, well, see, there you go. I don't, why would I, you know, why would I take four public servants, well, actually six, including the two agents, have your hand slapped for trying to do a good job, and maybe you didn't know what, you know, and the judge had, or, although he had stepped off the bench, he was standing right there. He says, you know, the old thing about ignorance is no excuse, you know, for the law. And I says, well, Your Honor, I agree with your statement there, but you can also grant grace. I can grant grace just as you can from the bench. He says, well put. He says, so you don't have any intention of prosecuting any one of those six there? I says, nah, seems like they've got it pretty much worked out and they know the right thing to do now, and that we'll never hear from them on a negative matter again. Not like this, we're not going to. And they all nodded their heads. Yes, that's so correct. Yeah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They, and they were, they realized, and what happened was that they realized that they didn't have jurisdiction. The children had been transferred to a facility about 100 miles away. And when we finalized the hearing, we asked them, well, how soon can we have the children here? He says, well, it'll take a day or two to process. I said, you know, and I turned around and looked at the family. I says, nod your heads up and down, side to side, back and forth, side to side, up and down. And I says, Your Honor, the family's willing to not press charges if there are children are delivered to them within the next 90 minutes, 2 hours at the most. And, you know, and, but Your Honor, you know, and he says, there you are. You guys got a chance to get off scot-free. But I'm going to have one of each of you stay here until the children get here. But Your Honor, well, there, you know, you guys can go. One of each of you, one of the ADAs or whoever's going to go get the children. They made some phone calls. The children were there in 84 minutes, just over 100 miles. They were probably doing a little bit more than 60 miles an hour, and somehow they managed to get them there very, very quickly. But when it comes to jurisdiction, that can be an extremely, extremely challenging subject. Jurisdiction in an IRS case recently came up that we had an individual who had not had his status updated, you know, and we used the term corrected. And please, one and all, everyone remember that the correction of your status is exclusively correcting the paperwork and the entries in the computer to match what you already are and have been all along. Now, to that end, right now we're filing an appeal in a case where someone had their, it just came up, this person actually had his status corrected, and we did his in 1995, and I found out that he had just a few years ago been convicted of a difficulty with the Treasury Department and IRS, and that we're filing a appeal for him right now. I'm not actually filing it. His wife has long since gone to law school, and although she's not a member of the bar, like myself, she had a lot of court orders, and I had court orders from U.S. District Court justices, senior, justices. I said I could practice before the 7th, the 9th, the 6th, the 3rd, you know, that and anything in, within their jurisdiction. Although I didn't have I wasn't a member of the bar and I didn't have a bar card. They say you didn't have a license to practice here. They're talking about a business license that is specific to the legal or to jurisprudence. Jurisprudence, the definition of it is the pursuit or the hobby of law. That's what jurisprudence is, the pursuit or hobby of the study of law. And so what happens is that it's like a licensed, you know, licensed air conditioning guy, licensed, you know, hair stylist. Well, Your Honor, if I don't have that license, does that mean that I can't do people's hair and cut their hair? I can't be a barber and I can't earn a living and buy food for my children and pay my bills? Oops. Yeah. Of all the noble and honorable sentiments that constantly generate laws like licensing of, you know, certain professions, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal. And to that end, you have to ask yourself, under 18 U.S.C. 242, 18 United States Code 242 or 241, would that be considered a felony? I mean, you have to ask yourself also, what's, you know, it says kidnapping, aggravated assault, or death occurs, and the death penalty can apply. But ask yourself, what's the statute for wrongful arrest? Oh, there isn't any. It's kidnapping under color of law. We, in a California jurisdiction just outside of San Diego, there's a peace officer that is currently, we've got a grand jury indictment against him for kidnapping under color of law. Now, I know the judge that this one's going to end up in front of, and it's probably, he'll probably get off, and that's kind of scary. But the thing is that we did get a grand jury indictment against him. So the folks that we were helping have a grand jury indictment on this. It's that's tough to do in California. Now, the thing is that when someone detains you and they didn't have jurisdiction, you have to ask yourself, does that constitute kidnapping under color of law? And it's, there's a lot of ways you can handle that. One of them is just very straightforward. You know, there's the people that are looking for an income opportunity. Ah, sue the guy, sue the department, sue everybody, you know. But there are some people on this call that their sole and exclusive desire for what we're doing is to restore liberty to America. You can have an event where you could cash in like that, or you could take that event and turn it around to be an educational opportunity, a moment of academia for not just that officer or deputy or ADA or the DAG, you know, Deputy Attorney General or whoever, and turn it around into a deposit to the Goodwill Bank, that they understand that you have the goods on them. You have them cold, dead to rights. And but when you let them and go based on the fact that they learned what is correct, and you, and like the CPS agents, well, right now, it looks like you guys were acting the best you could, the best way you knew how, but you weren't aware of the jurisdictional issues that applied to these young people here. But now you'd never do that again. So why should I need to prosecute that when you're trying to do a good job, the best job you can, the best way you know how? And as an employee of the people, I'm honored to do what I can to help you do your job. You know, and turn it around and make a deposit to the Goodwill Bank, and so that it begins to propagate and spread. Fire begets fire. You never fight fire with fire. There's only one place in the whole world that I've ever learned that fire, that is good fighting fire. And that's that if, you know, like you're in a forest fire and you start a backburn to destroy the potential fuel that an oncoming onslaught might devour, so that the fire you set reaches the other one, and then you've created a fire break. That's a rare, rare situation. Even in diplomatic sorts and cores, it's hard to find an opportunity where fire creates a backburn. Water is better. A little bit of respect and TLC is very, very, very good. And it's very important that you never forget that if you know what the rules are and they don't, and if you're as tactful as you possibly can, there's a chance that you might be able to win them over. And in this case, not the CPS attorney, but one of the CPS agents butted in and said, well, if that's the case, we should have never detained the children, and we need to give the children back to the parents. And I asked, I says, did you ever have any evidence of the alleged abuse, the physical injuries? And both the girls, the CPS agents said, no, well, that's the strange part. And the children seemed to be well bonded with the parents. And so what happened was, is when we finished up, I says, well, there you are. And they says, you know what, we need to talk to those folks that, you know, generated the complaint. And they did. And the lady that actually generated it got a 6-month suspended sentence for filing false charges. And but what happened was is that we were able to win over 6 people in a courtroom that we came in on a very adversarial basis, so that they were now rooting for this family of 5 and 2 adoptions, 3 of their own children, 2 adopted, you know, mom and dad. So what's extremely, extremely important is that as we go into each of these jurisdictional issues, we're going to figure out, we're going to see the application, figure out what the jurisdiction is, how they gained it, and determine if they actually have jurisdiction over us. Now, when you're doing that, if you don't know your status, that's tough to prove. As GW would tell you, you know, an affidavit is testimony and evidence that is ready, ripe for entry into the record. And when you file an affidavit in a case, that is de facto testimony and evidence. And unless they have an affiant that can testify in opposition to that, they're not even allowed to call into question that affidavit. Even if you haven't got your status corrected in the computer, going in with that affidavit, and I recommend that you, just like GW, that you originate multiple affidavits, do it as early as possible so they're as long-standing as possible. In many jurisdictions, the court clerks, the district court clerks don't, county clerks, I mean, they don't lets you just file anything anymore. It used to be that sometime, you know, that I sold a car to somebody that they did not register, and this car, I built the engine from scratch, and it was a little over 1,000 horsepower on street gas, and so what happened was is that some pictures that I took photocopies of, and my statement, I says, on this date, such and such, I sold this car to so-and-so, and hereby transferred it, you know, and VIN number, license plate number, and everything. This was in California, and this was back in 1977. And 2 years later, this gentleman was caught, was observed going over 200 miles per hour on the 5 freeway south of Oceanside. The California Highway Patrol could not catch up to him, but they had the license number. I got a knock on the door. They thanked me for my time. It was 3 in the morning, and invited me to Club Fed, and I left in bracelets. It took them almost 2 hours before we finally got to the LA County Sheriff's Station. And I says, look, let's go to the county clerk's office when it opens. And he says, no, we got you dead to rights. The guy that was driving looked a lot like me. He was tall, had sandy brown hair, and not vaguely unsimilar height and weight characteristics. But because I had filed that almost 2 years earlier, they let me go, and it never even went to court. The guy, they end up eventually getting him. But you used to be able to file just about anything. But nowadays, when you can, if you have evidence like an affidavit, file it at the county clerk's office, especially if it relates to something, most especially with a child that's born. There's still a lot of jurisdictions. I say an affidavit, and I say, hey, look, I get affidavits from the midwife and or both midwives if I've got two of them. And or a midwife and a witness, and we get a picture with a footprint, and we send it to the local newspaper, and we send it to two newspapers, and we get the cutouts of the newspaper, and we keep those, and that way individuals that were natural born, that don't have a birth certificate or a social security number, that they don't have any, the State Department or local government doesn't have any objections to those. And all of the aforementioned that I've just stated for you are all valid, testimony and evidence to support even getting a passport. Especially the baby's footprint. That's a big one. That establishes some jurisdiction that is incontrovertible. What you need to do on jurisdiction is establish as much incontrovertible evidence as possible. When you're working with GW, the jurisdiction that you're establishing there, don't just go get and author one single affidavit, because, you know, when you go to the State Department, it looks like get a passport. Get the passport, they're going to want a wet signed affidavit, original one. And take half a dozen when you go over the AAA or the bank and get them all notarized at the same time. And the older the dates on those, the longer standing the testament is of that evidence that you're providing. I don't mean to be curt, but my time has come to a close. My time for the information provider portion of this conference call is now done. Now we will be opening it up to questions and answers. Remember, although we prefer that you take, that you try to stay with the subject matter topic, you're not required to. You can ask a question on any topic. And with that, back to you, Michael.
Well, thank you so very, very much. The routine, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure, well, I don't see new callers here, first-time callers. So the routine is simple. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. I will be happy to give voice to your comment, to your question. No, I didn't say that right. Press star 2 on your keypad. I'll unmute your phone, and then you can give voice to your comment or question with John. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see in the center of your monitor, the to the right of it, a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of it, type away your comment or your question. On the outside underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and other things, and then just hit submit. I'll be happy to give voice to your comment or question. So we'll start with Anita from New York. Go ahead, Anita. All right, wait a minute. Something's not happening here. There we go. Go ahead, Anita.
Yes, thank you, John, for that true story. I really enjoyed it. I'm not sure. I have a small question. I'm not sure if I missed a little part of it, but there was no jurisdiction because the children didn't have birth certificates. So that was just by chance those children didn't have birth certificates, because I have an adopted child, you know, she came with a birth certificate. So that's my question.
This one was a private adoption, and what happened was both parents had a durable power of attorney with this other couple. They were both killed in a car accident.
Oh.
Both parents were part of a homeschool co-op that we may have regularly supported. And many years earlier, before the parents got married, the black couple, I had gotten the honor and privilege of helping them both get a passport without a social security number. They knew each other, but it was before they got married. And so they had already been aware through the homeschool co-op that we had done some little seminars and quick educational moments. This is back in the 90s. They they recorded their children's births in the newspaper, etc., just like, and the family Bible with witnesses, and they took their family Bible down and had it copied at the county clerk's office in in Denton, Texas, and recorded the page with the children's birth with the two midwives, two separate midwives both times, but they had two midwives for both births. But they were Anita, what happened was that this wasn't, now you're right, usually in a state adoption they're required, you know, to have the birth certificate there. And there are some cases where the state will ex post facto create a birth certificate for someone that didn't have one.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was great fortune that was all in place. I would say, yep. Or more than fortune, it was something else. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Anita.
All righty. Next is Miss Jennifer. I think. One moment.
Hi there, John and Mike.
Good evening, young lady.
So I was going to ask, well, is it hard to get rid of the birth certificate after your grandchildren have birth certificates? Like, I know they wouldn't be ever got completely rid of, but is it a hard or long process to remove yourself from that certificate? And then I have another question after that.
I know of some individuals that have tried to rescind birth certificates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The government's a little selfish and a little jealous about those. They consider that a contract that, and like the little children in the schoolyards, you know, no tapbacks, no races, you know, they don't let you rescind, even though you send them a letter rescinding it. I have seen in courtrooms only twice where the judge honored that and thereby the jurisdiction. In both cases, the affidavit rescinding it was more than 20 years old. And so the judge, there was some legitimate expectation that these individuals, it wasn't done, they didn't do a Teddy Kennedy thing where after he drives his car off the road into the water and kills somebody, shows up the next morning without completely devoid and divested of ownership of anything. That was something that was done under threat of potential litigation. So there are some judges that will accept that, but because this has become so obscure, there's only a few judges, and as strange as it sounds, the only ones that I found that really know about it are in family law courts. Does that answer your question a little bit?
So how does correcting your status, does that affect the birth certificate contract or not really?
Very good question.
It would be in the birth certificate would be in the same jurisdiction as the U.S. Corp.
May I ask you a couple of questions, young lady, on that?
Yes.
Okay. Is a birth certificate a state or a federal document?
Probably federal.
Really? What would make it federal?
The fact that every single person has to have one, no matter, and isn't United States Corp federal?
There's no legal requirement for birth certificate in any state.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a state.
What about a territory state?
Thank you. The territories and held possessions are governed by federal law, but the territory, the territorial governors is where the jurisdiction falls on that. Federal jurisdiction does not at this time have anything to do with the birth certificate. So the jurisdiction that is established by a birth certificate is one of the compact several states.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And so,
and that is,
when you, I guess when you're correcting your status, you're saying you're a citizen of a union state, which is
right.
What the birth certificate jurisdiction is under.
Exactly.
Oh.
You're just pointing out what they already know, but they don't want. They don't want discussed.
Okay. All right. Well, the other question is traffic court. The next thing they want me to do is come to a trial, even though they haven't answered my challenge of jurisdiction. So could I write a letter? Could,
have they said a date?
February 2nd or something like that.
Okay.
If I could show you, like you said to the judge in the courtroom, if I could show you something that could prevent, you know, like a crime, your court committing a crime, would you like me to tell you about that? Or could I write something like that in the letter to the judge saying, you know, if he doesn't answer before the date of the trial, I don't have to show up because he hasn't proven that I.
They frown on you not showing up. Technically, when you have a traffic infraction, and that's what it is, it's an infraction. Usually, unless you're doing 25 miles or over the speed limit, in most states that becomes a misdemeanor or a potential felony.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, hang on just a second. In the meantime, when you sign the ticket, you're technically not signing, admitting guilt. You're signing a bond. You're signing a PR bond, a personal recognizance bond, meaning that that is your promise to appear. If you don't sign the ticket, it has nothing to do whether you're guilty or not. And it used to be that there, back in the 60s and early 70s, there were some judges and jurisdictions where they said, you signed the ticket, you're guilty. Well, and so for a while, they would sign it non-assumpsit, and meaning that they were not admitting guilt, but so that they don't have to haul you down to the courthouse, wait for the judge to be on the bench, have him set bail, and then you post it. What happens is that they, nationwide, all the states, by 1973, almost all the states had come to a place where they allow an individual to bond out on a personal recognizance bond. So when you sign the ticket, you're signing that you're going to appear. You still need to appear, girl. It's just at this juncture, once you're there, once you're in the courtroom, say, Your Honor, here's a copy of my letter or my plea challenging jurisdiction. We still haven't got a response on that. And can we actually hold a hearing until jurisdiction is established? And they know that if a person challenges jurisdiction, there's nothing they can do until jurisdiction is established.
So I asked them to what? Hold a hearing?
No, they cannot. It says, Your Honor, is it legal to hold a hearing until jurisdiction has been established?
I see.
Yeah. Ask the question.
I don't think I signed the actual ticket. I gave it to them with an affidavit, but I didn't actually sign the ticket.
When you were pulled over? Did he give you his tablet for you to sign your name on it?
No.
They, you're certain?
Well, I've never been asked to sign anything when I'm pulled over, and I've only been pulled over like twice or three times in my life, but I don't remember being required to sign anything on the spot because I wouldn't do that.
Oh, that's
they
interesting
did, they,
because
they gave me a ticket that I had to then send to the court telling them whether I'm guilty or not guilty, and I was probably meant to sign that, but I didn't.
You know, when you were at, now you've been down to the courthouse already, right?
Yes.
You're saying that they asked you to sign something there?
Nope. I just handed them the ticket with the affidavit and the other evidence that you had done for me, and they stamped it, and I left. Nothing was signed except my affidavit and everything. But the actual ticket wasn't.
That's very peculiar. I don't know how to speak to that.
Okay.
There's an assumed, usually, promise to appear. So, it's my hearty recommendation that you always live your life with clean hands on a clean hands policy. Meaning that if you're objecting to it, I have friends that object to the IRS and we've worked with them and we've sent letters, but I've always encouraged them to keep, any withholdings, et cetera, not just paid, but in my early years, when I was filing, I overpaid. At one point, I had over $700,000, worth of refunds coming, while I was working through, some very, very complex issues. And when they says, you're an objector and a protester, you know, and actually in court, the lady says, look, this guy's been protesting, objecting for years, and he's not. And I said, I'd like to object to that, Your Honor. They're currently holding over $400,000 worth of withholdings that I've rolled over from year to year, while I work out the legal issues of whether I'm actually liable to pay for filing a 1040 and paying taxes. And when the judge heard that, he asked them. They didn't have a copy of the printout. That lady was, she had to go down to the Carson office in Southern California there and get a full printout. And she very sheepishly afterward says, he's right, Your Honor. He's over $400,000 to the good. And when I was sorting out my income tax issues, hey, I was single, I was young, I was crazy, I was wacko, you know. And some people say, what do you mean, was, John? You know,
but the words out of my mouth.
Yeah, really. That's not, be careful. That can be unsanitary. There was a testament to that bench that transcended anything, any words I could have said when he realized that I may have been making good money back then. There was times where my weekly gross check was just under $4,000, and my take home was just under two. Whereas it was averaging $1,700 to $1,800 a week take home. I was very well employed back then, you know. What happens is that having a clean hands policy is a testament to the bench that if you're going to help restore liberty, having clean hands is a shockingly powerful tool. Whether it's property tax, income tax, sales tax, this tax, that tax, or thumb tax, You know, it's a, you know, having a clean hands policy is a shockingly powerful tool, especially when it comes to cussing and discussing before a bench.
Okay, thank you. Well, so I shouldn't write that in a letter then to the judge.
Right.
I like the thumbtacks one better, though. I have one more question now because I have this property tax bill that has two sentences. A new deed of for this property has not been recorded, and in there's 2 years of unpaid property tax. The county will take title and auction, do a tax auction if it's not paid by January 31st. So I've been holding off paying the money because I didn't know whether I should answer those two statements that they've made with the money, or just send the money and ignore those two statements they made, or send an affidavit or something later to answer them.
Now, one thing that's very important about that, girl, is that there is a teeny weeny bit of research needed and required to carry yours to fruition. Okay. To that end, what we want to do is absolutely, if there's any way to maintain a clean hands policy all the way up to it, it's very important. Now, we file it when we say, hey, look, guys, I disagree with this. In fact, I believe that it's civilly wrong and it's actually criminally wrong. But until we get this resolved in a court of law, I'm paying this under protest.
Okay, so should I just write that note in with, or should I write it as an affidavit?
You can make an affidavit out of that. But if you just, you know, make it very clear that that you're paying it under protest, what that does is that reserves your rights for recourse on that, so that those funds that were paid under protest, once this thing is adjudicated, you can get all those funds back.
Okay. Oh, did you ever get your $700,000 back?
Actually, I used to have some very expensive hobbies back then. I like flying and scuba diving and skydiving and snow skiing and surfing. And then I got a more expensive hobby called a wife. And and I'll tell you, girl, we got married, when we got engaged, she asked if she could do a prenup. And I says, what do you mean, prenup? And I says, I have all this debt that you can't imagine. And, my property has been, I took a second out on it and I mortgaged it. And now the market got soft and it's upside down. And she says, there's going to be a brutal, horrible, I've got to sell the property and get out of it. And there's going to be an unbelievably brutal capital gains tax and this and that. And so what happened was our first year of marriage, I used up most of that. You know, I went ahead and, I took my darling bride as she came and I told her, I says, there won't be any prenup. You are the one that God bought into my life. There's no ifs, ands, or buts, or candy, or nuts. I take you as you come. And, that includes your debt. And, Jennifer, I would never have a clue how much that meant till the first time I got a clue was 12 years later, where she was telling four other ladies at church about what I did, and they were swooning, and two of them were crying, you know, and I never realized how much of an impact that had on her. But, yes, I did use it up.
So you did get it back from the IRS, but you used
well,
it all up.
Yeah. But hey, I was young. Like I said, I was young. I was crazy. I was out of control. I had a great job. And, you know, I was, I was the classic, Playboy James Bond, kid without the womanizing. You know, and my wife and I didn't even meet till we were in our mid-30s, till we were in our 30s, Jennifer, and we were both love's first kiss for each other.
Nice. Soulmates.
Yep. She's anyway. My bestest friend in the whole wide world, and my son is my second bestest friend. Okay.
Well, lucky still alive, and I've got four children that are alive, but my husband, unfortunately, departed. Anyway, I'll let you go to the next person. Sorry for taking so much time. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. You take care.
You too.
All right. Thank you, Miss Jennifer. Anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to say goodnight. I want to remind everyone that next week, Johnny Ringo will be returning, and you'll be going back to class again with regards to Title 18. And that's a very important thing to talk about, because it totally exposes the fraud of our federal government. My computer screen just went white on me. I'm glad it didn't go blue. So let me give it a second to try to catch up with itself. Let me see if I've got this on my phone already to go. Maybe I can see it better there. Stand by. Da, 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 da. Still hasn't woken up. There we go. All right. So, Johnny, would you like to say something before we say goodnight? Tell us what we're going to be looking at next week.
No, just kind of a preview of what I already stated. He has several more documents stating the ineptness of the federal government. And I got something from the Attorney General, which is very, very interesting.
Well, good. When John and you have some time, I'd love to put you together for a private conference call and share some theories and thoughts on different matters. Brian just raised his hand, so let's go to Brian real quickly and he'll be the last caller for tonight. See if he's got his phone unmuted, or I've got mine. Brian, there we go. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, Michael, are you there?
No, I've not. I left for the evening. But thank you for asking.
Yeah,
John's here, though. He'll talk to you.
Not me. I'm some other guy from the Bronx.
I figured you did, Michael. You texted me tonight on or the other night on a Sovereign Shopping Club. Was this a good time to bring that up, or is that?
No. Not on these calls, no.
Okay. So that was my only thing. Other than that, I'm fine.
All right. All righty then. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. Remind you again tomorrow night to return. You're going to learn how, either as a entrepreneur or as an employee, that's a legal term for the Internal Revenue Code. As an employee or as an entrepreneur, you can operate through an LLC that effectively and perfectly within the law strips the income tax obligation. So until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
Best wishes.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Great call tonight. Appreciate you.
An honor and a privilege, my brother. You take care of yourself.
Will do. Yes, sir.
Night.
Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.